Remind you of the setting of these lectures. So we have a compact Riemannian manifold. Again. And Del Laplacian acting function. Okay, and in this one I want to talk about the concentration of eigenfunctions. So maybe changing the notation a little bit. I'll look at eigenfunctions with eigenvalue lambda. And here I'm concerned not with the small eigenvalues, but what happens to the eigenfunctions when the eigenvalue goes to infinity. So just to give a couple simple examples to see intuitively what we might mean by concentration of eigenfunctions, I'll give one non-example and one example. So the first thing which everyone learns is Fourier series. So you could take the circle, and then eigenfunctions are sines and cosines. So I could take sine of nx. And at least from the point of view that I'm taking today, this is an example where it doesn't concentrate. Say the L infinity norm is bounded as n goes to infinity, so that the eigenvalue is n squared. So that's a non-example. Now, naively, you might at first think that that's, you know, what eigenfunctions look like, that they just sort of always oscillate like sines and cosines. But you can give simple examples, and this is one. So if you take the two-sphere, and then you take a complex-valued eigenfunction, which depends only on the first two variables, then as n goes to infinity, which is the eigenvalue, as we said last time, is around n squared, this will concentrate on the equator. Or near. There, I'm about to give that. I was just trying to give some intuitive idea before I gave the strict definition. So this is the intuitive idea. So since here x squared plus y squared plus z squared is equal to 1, obviously when you take the absolute value of this, that'll be a number less than or equal to 1 and then raised to the nth power. So it's going to concentrate where x squared plus y squared is equal to 1, which is the equator. All right, now, how then do you make precise the idea of what concentration means mathematically? Essentially, I know of two ways to do that. One of them is, I guess, fashionable in the quantum chaos, which is to use a certain measure and look at the concentration of that, the square of the eigenfunction times the volume form. Another way, which is the one I'll talk about now, and that's for the whole lecture, I'll measure concentration by looking at the ratio of the L infinity norm of the eigenfunction over its L2 norm. So if, now I'm really looking at a sequence of eigenfunctions rather than a single eigenfunction. So if this, say, along some subsequence of the eigenfunctions grows, for example, as a power of the eigenvalue, then that would be something that's concentrating and sort of peaking there. So as an exercise, you might want to look at number two and see, in this sense, how it concentrates. I mean, what power, in the example two, what power would you get of the eigenvalue when you go to infinity? I won't do that. But you'll definitely see you get a power law growth in this concentration near the equator. Yeah, it's always implicitly I'm talking about a sequence, and the eigenvalue is going to infinity. Mm-hmm. But it may be just a subsequence of all the eigenfunctions. All right, so let me start with the elementary proposition. This is not at all the best possible, but this is instructive to do. So suppose you take any fixed compact manifold, then for a constant depending on that manifold, you can always get this estimate. For all eigenfunctions. So that's some sort of crude upper bound on what the concentration could be. And let me give the proof of this. This is something that could well appear in your first PDE course. This is just deduced by scaling out of a standard elliptic theory. So how would you do this? So suppose you give a compact manifold, so it has to be a point where the supremum is assumed. And then the argument is primarily local. So then you restrict to a ball. And it's quite a fundamental idea to understand what the size of a ball you should be looking at. The natural level to look at in terms of the parameter lambda when you're going to lambda go to infinity is something proportional to lambda to the minus a half. And here you can use normal coordinates. Okay, so then you rescale, you define a function on a standard size ball, which is h of x equals f of lambda to the minus a half of x. And you then this will be defined for x less than c. So its domain of definition is now a standard size ball. And then you look at the equation satisfied by H, so I'm sort of out of space there. The first derivative in e to the power lambda 2 minus a half the second derivative, you get lambda inverse now f is the eigenfunction satisfies the equation which depends on this parameter lambda, so with I guess an obvious notation. So last time I wrote out the formula for what the Laplacian is in local coordinates. So then you have to just interpret this B in the obvious way. So this is the eigenfunction equation where B depends on the metric and its first derivative. And if you divide this by lambda, what you'll get is a standardized equation for H. Now we're interested in large lambda, so the coefficients of this are bounded as lambda goes to infinity. And then by standard PDE for the H, the standard elliptic theory, you can compare the L infinity norm and the L2 norm of H. So by the elementary elliptic theory, you get H less than some constant times H2. I don't know if I need to relabel my constant. Of course, it has nothing to do with that constant. All right, so it's C1 or something. So that's a new constant. Rescale. Now, what happens when you rescale? Well, L infinity norm, that doesn't depend on scale, so that's invariant. But L2 norm, of course, it does, and that's going to be where this lambda to the n minus 4 comes from. So if you take h squared x dx, you get integral, let's see, f squared lambda to the minus a half x dx. And then, I don't know if I said what the dimension is, but anyway, I should have said that I'm using the usual notation that that's the dimension. So you'll get, when you rescale in this L2 norm, lambda to the n over 2 f squared y dy. And then, of course, the L2 norm is the square root of this, and the L infinity norm is scale invariant, so then that will give you this elementary proposition. So, although this is a crude technique, it reveals certain interesting things. What I see as a primary one is that the fundamental way to approach these kind of problems is to work on that scale. This is true a lot for also the nodal set things. Of course, if you want to get sharp results, you'll have to come up with better ideas. But this is where you start. Okay, so another thing which is well worth knowing and may increase the interest of people learning the subject is the connection of this with multiplicity. So until you become accustomed to this, this might seem like sort of a dry topic. You say, who cares to study this? Whereas something which seems more interesting, I think, is the dimension of the eigenspaces. And these are very closely related. So let me explain why that's so, with another elementary proposition. And then I'll get on to a substantial theorem. It would be nice if I had some more chalk, though. Is there a source of chalk somewhere? Yeah, some chalk here. Okay, so suppose then we have a large eigenspace, say. So if the eigenvalue has a multiplicity, in some lambda, then this, by taking appropriate linear combinations, is going to result in some sort of concentration. There exists an eigenfunction satisfying the L infinity norm is greater or equal to a constant times square root of the multiplicity times its L2 norm. Right, so this is well worth knowing, so I'd like to also indicate the proof of this one. How do we find this eigenfunction? All right, well, we look at the projection kernel, the Bergmann kernel, for projection onto this particular eigenspace. So then, and now what are the phi I? Phi I is an orthonormal basis for the eigenspace with a fixed eigenvalue. Okay, so then, on the one hand, if we integrate this, restrict it to the diagonal, and integrate, what do we get? So this is normalized in L2, so we get some we get this, and these all integrate to 1, so we get the multiplicity. And then, of course, if the L infinity norm is going to concentrate, there has to be a point where it concentrates. And the way we get it is, since this integral is perhaps big if it's a large eigenspace, there has to be exist a p for some p the kernel has to be bigger than the multiplicity divided by the volume of the manifold. Yeah, this is progress, but then there's a little bit more argument that's needed. So I want to have a single eigenfunction, which is large. If I can push this up. So what will I do? The eigenfunction is going to concentrate at that particular point that I've chosen. So then I can consider the evaluation map which is just to take an eigenfunction and assign it to its value at that point. All right, and this is for all looking at eigenfunctions in this fixed eigenspace. Still, so I'm always in this particular proof having a single eigenvalue in mind. All right, so then, well, this is obviously linear transformation between two finite dimensional vector spaces, and the range is one dimensional. So if then I take something which is orthogonal to the kernel, then I can extend that to an orthonormal basis where all the other eigenfunctions vanish. So because this kernel is big and it's independent of the choice of basis, it'll have to be that since everything else in this particular basis vanishes at that point, it'll have to be that that single eigenfunction is big. Now, this is another elementary but instructive kind of argument to have to see this connection. Now, of course, it doesn't go the other way. I mean, you can't have the concentration without the multiplicity. But this does show some examples. And then I can bring to bear the calculations I did last time for the sphere. So let's look at what happens for the sphere when I use this proposition 2. So last time we at least pointed out and to some extent justified that with a standard metric we get the eigenvalues k times n plus k minus 1. And for that particular eigenspace, we also computed the dimension of the eigenspace and the multiplicity, so we got that the dimension of the eigenspace was n plus k choose k minus n plus k minus 2 k minus 2. And I suppose this was the part that I left as a rather hard exercise for the beginners, that was really the correct dimension. Anyway, if you do then some simple arithmetic or algebra to relate it to what I've just been saying, you'll see that this is bigger than a constant k to the n minus 1. And then since the eigenvalue here, n is a dimension, which is fixed, so we're letting k go to infinity. So this is the eigenvalues around k squared. So this is greater than, for large lambda to the n minus 1 over 2. So what the study of the spherical harmonics does, combined with the proposition 2, it says that we have a concentration on the sphere. So we get examples where the eigenvalue, the eigenfunction in L infinity norm is bigger than a constant times lambda to the n minus 1 over 4 times its L2 norm. Okay, so this naturally raises a question if you compare it with the first proposition, which I hope is still up here. All right, so the elementary PDE rescaling seemed to give that the natural bound was lambda to the n over 4, and I think naively you would perhaps expect that that's the best possible. That's certainly the best possible if you work strictly locally. So you can find germs of eigenfunctions which have this growth. So On the other hand, here we found examples on the sphere where you have a bound the other way, but it doesn't quite match. There's this discrepancy of a quarter. So the elementary argument gave n over 4. Maybe you would, if you haven't seen this before, hope that that's the best possible. Now this suggests that you have to come up with a more sophisticated proof than what Proposition 1 was, or you have to find better examples, different examples. Now it turns out that the correct resolution of this is that the technique has to be improved. So the theorem, which is usually credited to Hormander, is the following. Well, maybe in my lettering, it's supposed to be 3. So this is for any compact Riemannian manifold. Eigenfunction, the L infinity norm is less than constant times n minus 1 over 4 times the L2 norm for eigenfunctions with eigenvalue lambda. And again, here we're really only concerned with large lambda. But this just says that there exists a constant, so in some sense it doesn't say anything when lambda is small. The constant C might depend on, will depend on the manifold. Okay, so now, even though this is conventionally attributed to Hormander, there are numerous people that have worked on this. This is a fundamental result, both before and after Hormander. I think what Hormander, in some sense, really did was to get a general version for elliptic operators of arbitrary order. It was really known for second order before that. And subsequently, a number of people also have simplified his proof in various ways. All right, so I wanted to say something about the proof. Now, this is some version. First, Chris Sogg did a certain amount of work, and then I did more work where I was concerned with the geometric dependence of this constant. How does it depend on the curvature and diameter of the manifold? And that's a fairly recent paper. I won't emphasize so much the geometric dependence, but I want to outline this proof because I think it's sort of interesting in itself, even if you don't get entangled in the issue of geometric dependence, which is maybe a more advanced thing that I should be doing in introductory lectures. All right, so what is this version of Hormander's argument, which is developed first by Sogg and then by myself? Okay, there are quite a few interesting ideas in this, so rather than doing the complete details, I'd like to get the ideas out. All right, the first part of this is, rather than working with the weight equation directly, as Hormander did, we work instead with the Bessel potentials. So I don't know if this should be called the proof. well, let's say this is the proof print as the outline or something. So the thing I did for the first two propositions, that's really the proof. That's the complete proof. But this one, I don't think I can do more than illustrate the essentials of it. All right. So one of the first things, then, is to consider certain kernels on Rn. So we consider the Bessel potentials. Rn. Okay, and then these things are the resolving kernels for del plus z inverse. And we'll need here to have, at least as far as I could ever see in this proof, to look at the complex values outside the spectrum. So the positive real numbers is the spectrum. Okay, so at least in a distribution sense, these things are written down in the following way. Of course, this doesn't converge. It has to be suitably interpreted. Now, the point about this, perhaps more pertaining to my paper about geodetic dependence than anybody else, I mean, I think maybe Hormander and Sog didn't really worry about how things depend on curvature and diameter, but it's more my inclination to do so. So if you are concerned about geometric dependence, then a good feature of this is its rotational symmetry. This is really, I mean, you can check it from the formula. It's an obvious consequence of the rotational symmetry of the Euclidean metric about the origin. And therefore, what you have is that it satisfies, of course, this equation, the Bessel's equation. That's, I suppose, why it's called the Bessel potential. Outside the origin. And if you have a kernel which has a rotational symmetry, this kind of same kind of argument applies to the heat kernel, say. You can hope to use comparison theory from differential geometry to take results which are analysis results and then really say how the constants appearing in them depend on the geometric invariance. So the basic tool for that, there are two things, two lemmas. Now, let's see. I think I pushed this one up, maybe. Okay, so now suppose we want to work on a Riemannian manifold. This board is all about just about Rn. So then what we do is transplant. So we take this kernel, and at least locally, by interpreting R to be the geodesic distance in the manifold instead of the Euclidean distance, we can move the kernel over to the manifold. Of course, they won't be an exact solution, but we can use it as a parametric to construct an exact solution. So R. So since it's rotationally symmetric, it's no, is it? I thought you meant that I just made a sign mistake. I don't know. Isn't I think it's actually supposed to be minus. No, it's a complex number. Just a complex number. So this, the whole thing depends on this complex number, which is not in the positive field. Prime is derivative in R, right. That's how we can make sense of this when we go into a manifold, to go into normal coordinates. We'll again always take prime to be derivative in R. Okay, so what were the lemmas? I guess here All right, so I tried to impromptu way to reorganize, but all right, so if I keep numbering, this will be a lemma. Okay, so one thing is now I'm on a Riemannian manifold, so if I have a function of the geodesic distance. And this is just local on M where I'm staying inside a normal coordinate patch. And if I work in spherical normal coordinates, which I guess is almost self-explanatory, I take normal coordinates and then pass to the corresponding Euclidean spherical coordinates. The Laplacian. Now this is the Laplacian of the Riemannian metric, and this is derivative with respect to the distance in the metric. And what's theta? The theta is essentially the volume element, so it's r to the n minus 1 in Euclidean space, and in these coordinates the volume element is some weight, theta, dr, d omega. No. Okay, well, I guess we'll skip this one. This is just like the calculation I did at the very beginning last time, following from the definition, integrate by parts in these coordinates. Integrate in the radial direction, and you'll get this log derivative of the volume element. Now, one of the very useful things in trying to study geometric dependence is that there's a comparison theorem, which probably is due to Richard Bishop. Certainly a very well-known theorem. So the most elementary comparison theorem that you do in a Riemannian geometry course is you compare volume growth, but there's a more refined version of that, which is the one that's useful in these PDE problems, where you actually have an estimate of the log derivative of the volume element. So let me state that one. So this one definitely... although it's very standard, it's considerably more substantive than the lemma 4. So this says the following. Suppose that the injectivity radius M bounded below by some constant better start using a different letter here. Start using A instead of C because I have so many C's. The curvature, the sectional curvature is bounded in absolute value by another constant. If I stay in a small enough ball, so the radius of this ball has to be less than the injectivity radius of the manifold where the exponential maps a diffeomorphism, and what the injectivity radius would be for a corresponding sphere with that curvature, the upper bound, A2. And this is in Bishop and Crittenden's textbook, and I think, I'm not really sure whether this is originally due to Bishop or not. I guess if you look at that, you'll see the reference anyway. Okay, so this is what the log derivative would be for a standard sphere with the curvature A2. And then it'll say that log derivative is less than or equal to the log derivative on our manifold M with variable curvature. And then in the other direction, we have a comparison, if we stay within the injectivity radius, of a hyperbolic space, something with curvature minus A2. So that'll say it's less than root C3 and minus 1 cotangent of root A2 R. So this is an important tool for finding the geometric dependence of PDE results. Okay, let's look at it now. Let's see. Oh, here's another spin. I mean, unfortunately, I tried to change too many things from my notes. Does that look all right now? Yeah, okay. So we can use this for many things, heat kernels also. The heat kernel will have this rotational symmetry, and we can transplant it. Now, let me move this up. So how do we use it in this particular problem, the Hormander's, the geometric dependence in the Hormander's theorem? The reference for this one, this is a textbook, Bishop Crittenden. I think it has a title like Geometry of Manifolds. I'm not so sure of that. Anyway, I think there's only one textbook with these two authors. All right. So, now I won't be able to still give the complete proof. In some sense, I have the ingredients up here for the proof. So if you mix the two lemmas and the preliminary remarks about the vessel potential, you certainly see the direction of the proof. Now let me say a little bit more in the 5 minutes that I have. Alright, so suppose then, looks like in the easy lemma, we go to the point where the soup is assumed. So we're trying to show, remember the theorem 3? So we take an eigenfunction and we look at the point where it's assumed it's soup. I guess I could put absolute values there. It doesn't really matter. And then, just like before, I choose normal coordinates. So the argument really is primarily local still. The global ingredient is sort of hidden. It really lies in the fact that there is an injectivity radius, for example, whereas on a non-compact manifold, you might not have a lower bound everywhere on the non-compact thing. Okay, so this Bessel potential was rotationally symmetric, so we can transplant it to the manifold by interpreting R to be the geodesic distance instead of the Euclidean distance. So we transplant BZ to the manifold from the Euclidean space into this, just in this local coordinate system, as a function of the geodesic distance R. Okay, and then we can do a calculation. So if we take, of course, as I said, we don't expect that this is going to be the resolvent. That would be silly. But this two lemmas, 4 and 5, will allow us to somehow estimate the discrepancy. So here, eta is a cutoff function. The standard cutoff function, which is 1 near a neighborhood of P and supported in a normal coordinate chart. So we can compute this. We've got a delta function, which you would get from the Bessel potential in Euclidean space because it's like a Green's kernel. This is in distribution sense. Now, there are a couple more interesting things here to say. This is then not really talking about the eigenfunction too much. This is just a transplant of the Bessel potential then cut off. How then do we continue? I guess we won't really finish the argument, but I'll get it to a point where I think many people will be convinced that it's more or less routine to finish it. All right, so I have that. Now, suppose then also I use the eigenfunction equation. I really haven't used that yet in this description of the proof. So this is some equation which holds in distribution sense, and then I compare it with the eigenfunction and use the eigenfunction equation. And so what I get, now there's a little bit tricky thing here, which I don't really know how to justify, except that it works. Here I have a complex number which is not to belong to the spectrum, but I'm free to choose it. And it, in order to get the sharp estimate, it seems to be that this is the right thing to choose. So I had two parameters floating around in this, the eigenvalue and the z. And now I, for not very conceptual reasons that I know, this is the correct thing to take for the z to get the good estimate. So then when you take this equation by for the transplant of the Bessel potential and you pair it with the eigenfunction and you do some little bit of elementary calculation, you'll get a bound of this sort. Now what's this R here? The R is a differential operator of order 1. This is first derivatives, and it has bounded coefficients. Now, I've I guess sort of exhausted my time, but let me just say this at least, maybe I should put absolute values here, seems like some justification that there's enough structure here that if you keep pushing at it, you can do it. I mean, you have this upper bound, you know quite explicitly these are Bessel functions, and now you'll have to evaluate these integrals. What it requires is some asymptotics of the kernels, both for small values. And what you do is for the small values, when you're on a scale ball less than lambda to the minus a half, you take certain terms and move them over and using the small stuff. And then you have to analyze the large stuff using the asymptotics of the Bessel function. Anyway, this is development of SOG paper, and it's also in my paper not too long ago in Journal of Functional Analysis. So this is some indication of how the proof goes. I guess I'm over time.